There are many types of dictatorships. Those of fiction writing, those of reality, those of the West, those of the East. But there is one commonality that unites them all. The assumption, from their own perspective, that they're absolutely unquestionably right, and therefore everybody else's worldview is to be condemned or destroyed. This video will try to explain a special type of dictatorship, that described in the novel Brave New World, written by the last century English intellectual Aldous Huxley. Long story short, the book describes a society in which everybody's comfort and physical well-being is guaranteed by the government, but at a cost. Losing your individual freedoms and being marginalized if you try to question the status quo. The special thing with this particular type of dictatorship is that it is so subtle and people are so accustomed to it that they just don't notice that they're in one. Like the fishes that ask, "What is water?" Or more precisely, like the frog that isn't aware that the water is warming so much that they might be dead very soon. This analogy is pertinent to the state of affairs in which the world is in right now, as will be argued in this video. In this so-called pandemic scenario, many people around the world are following each and every instruction that the governments and so-called experts are giving, firmly believing that their security is being taken care of. But is it? Unless you've been living in a bunker or in the jungle during this 2020, you've surely noticed that there's something weird and very fishy about the way that the medical community, worldwide, is taking care of this so-called pandemic. This video is an attempt to bring together all these anomalies and to offer some proposals. But given that the global situation is so highly complex, the narrative will be focused on the scientific aspects of this COVID-19 crisis. Or should I say, COVID-19 dictatorship. Remember the definition we gave for this. It is the assumption that one is absolutely, unquestionably right, and therefore everybody else's opinion should be censored, like the censorship that many people are suffering these days, precisely by the so-called scientific authorities, which are now expressing deep and serious contradictions. But here's the million-dollar question. Are they being contradictory because they're evil? Because they're being forced by a bureaucratic and obsolete health system? Or because they're ignorant to another and better way to deal with what's happening right now? The assumption of this documentary is that most scientists and medical doctors are well-intentioned and are simply following the World Health Organization's chain of command, blindly believing that they will provide the answer. But nothing seems to be going better, is it? There's still people dying during the lockdown. Why? Is it because of a virus? Or is it because of a combination of other factors that contradict the current scientific paradigm? Paradigm is a key word. According to the philosopher Thomas Kuhn, a paradigm is a set of rational rules that a community adheres to in order to comprehend a real-world phenomena. But when, eventually, that set of rules are found deeply inadequate to understand the world, they need to be replaced with new ones. There needs to be a paradigm shift. There needs to be a scientific revolution, which is part of the name of his most famous book. But Thomas Kuhn didn't ever foresee what we're living in right now, and what Aldous Huxley could very clearly foresee. Humanity has fallen into the trap of the scientific dictatorship. And so now, more than ever, a scientific revolution has to take place. In this unprecedented situation, the true revolution will have to involve a return to the roots in order to find what went wrong along the way and why the tree of humanity has grown so crooked. In other words, this documentary is proposing that nobody has to reinvent the wheel to come out of this health crisis, but only to turn back in history and retake an invention that has been forgotten and buried. The terrain theory of disease. In the next few minutes, it will be argued that we should have never taken the road of the germ theory. Around the beginning of the 19th century, the English scientist Edward Jenner began manufacturing the first vaccinations. At that time, the smallpox disease was very common in England, and so was the cowpox disease. After hearing rumors that people who had been in contact with diseased cows didn't develop severe smallpox, he decided to take the pus out of the cow's bruises and introduce it into the skin of healthy persons, who then developed mild to moderate allergic symptoms. And after some time, he now took the pus out of the bruises of people with smallpox and introduced it into the skin of the same healthy persons, who then again developed mild to moderate allergic symptoms. His conclusions, which are gathered in his brief book, An Inquiry into the Causes and Effects of the Variolae Vaccinae, claimed that since these persons didn't develop smallpox, it meant that his method had worked. It goes without saying that this procedure was very far from what we now consider to be a serious scientific research, with control groups and double-blind analysis. As a relevant fact, it should be noted that the word vaccine derives from the Latin translation for cow, vacca. During the first years of the 19th century, the Hungarian obstetrician Ignaz Semmelweis introduced the practice of washing the hands of doctors before any surgery. He observed that in the hospital where he worked, there were more women dying of what was then called childbed or puerperal fever than in other facilities, and he concluded that this difference was due to the fact that in his own hospital, there was an extended practice of analyzing cadavers just before giving birth to babies. And although he didn't attribute the cause of deaths to any particular substance, because the discovery of microorganisms came later, the medical establishment of the next decades attributed this to the bacteria present in the cadavers. In any case, his solution was to make every doctor wash their hands with a chlorinated solution. And it must be mentioned, in passing, that some years later the British surgeon Joseph Lister extended this practice to every medical utensil and clothing. And as a matter of historical fact, the death rate of these women reduced dramatically after this. The very crucial caveat, however, is that they weren't being infected by any microorganism whatsoever, but the symptoms they developed were due to the toxic chemicals contained in the cadaver's pus, rotten blood, and dead cells. Also, because of the fact that these women were receiving such toxic materials directly into the bloodstream of their internal organs, without passing through the several layers of toxicity filters on the digestive system, the symptoms they developed were that severe. The third of the forefathers of the germ theory was the French Louis Pasteur, who during the middle of the 19th century did a series of experiments which provided evidence for the existence of microorganisms, which he claimed were the cause of many diseases. And to kill those microorganisms, he developed a chemical method now known as pasteurization. Out of the four germ theory forerunners, he's probably the most known of all. But what's not that well known is that he had a contemporary scientific colleague named Antoine Béchamp, from whom Pasteur took most, if not all, of his ideas, but perverted them. As documented in the book Béchamp or Pasteur, a lost chapter in the history of biology, the main reason that Pasteur's ideas were widely adopted was not because of any scientific accuracy or true innovation, but because he had many political relationships. Also, as this book clearly explains, Pasteur was a scientific fraud and a charlatan, because he stole most of his ideas from Béchamp and claimed them as his own, after twisting the empirical facts. And to make matters worse, it is now known that in his personal diaries, for which he gave explicit instructions to his family to not publish them after his death, Pasteur wrote what he really thought about the causes of disease, which have nothing at all to do with microorganisms, as documented in the book The Private Science of Louis Pasteur. In fact, on his deathbed, Pasteur is remembered to have said, "The germ is nothing at all. The terrain is absolutely everything." During the second half of the 19th century, the fourth and last of the germ theory founders, made his contribution to the paradigm. In a time where the tuberculosis disease was very common in Europe, this German scientist developed a series of postulates that he believed would prove what Pasteur had theorized, that microorganisms were the cause of disease. These postulates are: 1. The microorganism must be found in abundance in all organisms suffering from the disease, but should not be found in healthy organisms. 2. The microorganism must be isolated from a diseased organism and grown in pure culture. 3. The culture microorganism should cause disease when introduced into a healthy organism. And 4th, which is a repetition of the first ones, the microorganism must be re-isolated from the second disease experimental host and identified as being identical to the original causative microorganism. Medical history books claim that he performed these steps for the Mycobacterium tuberculosis bacteria, for which he received the Nobel Prize of Medicine in 1905. Nevertheless, as will be shown in the rest of this video, these postulates are seriously wrong, and not a single microorganism has been determined as the cause of any disease. To conclude this introduction, it must be said that at the beginning of the 19th century, the first and second richest men in the world decided to join forces in order to change the curriculum of medical schools worldwide, according to the ideas developed by Jenner, Semmelweis, Pasteur, and Koch, as described in the film Hippocratic Hypocrisy.
But the real horror started in 1904, when the AMA founded the Council on Medical Education to regulate medical schools and what type of medicine could be taught in them, as osteopathic and homeopathic medicine had no commercial profit incentive to these snakes. They had to go. From its earliest inception, the American Medical Association has had one principal objective: attaining and defending a total monopoly of the practice of medicine in the United States. From its outset, the AMA made the unholy trinity of allopathy the basis of its practice. Allopathy set up an intense rivalry with the prevalent 19th century school of medicine, the practice of homeopathy. The AMA is one of the biggest frauds in history, involved in medical bribery, racketeering, corruption, coercion, and deception. In 1907, the American Medical Association involved the Carnegie Foundation in elaborating a book-length study of medical education in the United States and Canada, also known as the Carnegie Foundation Bulletin No. 4. Its author, Abraham Flexner, was an ambitious educator, neither a physician nor a medical scientist, but the brother of Simon Flexner, employed by the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research. Later on, Flexner became the first director of the Rockefeller Philanthropy Programs in Medical Education. Andrew Carnegie was regarded as the second richest man in history after John D. Rockefeller. While Carnegie played a leading role in the American steel industry and education, Rockefeller was interested in the oil industry and medical research. Before the Flexner Report was released, twice as many physicians practiced alternative medicine than conventional allopathic medicine, and medical knowledge was taught in small private schools all over the United States. The report changed everything, and backed by the police power of each American state, medical schools were obliged to follow the trends set by the Carnegie Foundation. The Flexner Report stated that the human body belongs to the animal world. It is put together of tissues and organs. It grows, reproduces itself, decays according to general laws. It is liable to attack by hostile physical and biological agencies. Herbs, homeopathy, Chiropractic and massage were demoted as quackery. Small medical schools were either closed or merged into universities financially supported by large industrial companies. In 1997, the WHO obtained full control over medicine as the validity of the Flexner Report extended worldwide.
After that introduction, let's now analyze the following 8 points of why the SARS-CoV-2 virus is not the cause that people are getting sick and dying. 1. Viruses are extremely diminute. According to the Merriam-Webster Encyclopedia, viruses are very tiny particles. On average, a bacteria is between 20 and 50 times bigger than a virus, whereas human cells are between 500 and 5,000 times bigger. This means that a virus is to a face mask as a mosquito is to a chain hole. But what doesn't escape the face mask, however, is the toxic cloud of carbon dioxide that we continuously exhale, which is one of the real causes of the respiratory disease labeled as COVID-19, as we'll explain in the 7th point. 2. Viruses have no metabolism, and therefore, no life. According to the Scientific American magazine, for about 100 years, the scientific community has repeatedly changed its collective mind over what viruses are, first seen as poisons, then as life forms, then biological chemicals. Viruses today are thought of as being in a gray area between living and non-living. They cannot replicate on their own, but can do so in truly living cells. In essence, viruses are just genetic information inside a shell of protein which can take many forms. 3. The PCR test is not meant for diagnostics. Given that viruses are so small, they need to be amplified in order to be seen. And there are two ways for doing this. The first one is with the help of an electron microscope, developed in 1931. But given that this instrument cannot differentiate between different types of viruses, because it cannot analyze the genetic material inside their shells, a method called the polymerase chain reaction, PCR, was developed for this purpose. This invention made the scientist Carl Mullis win the Nobel Prize of Chemistry in 1993. In simple terms, after this machine is calibrated for detecting a specific sequence of genetic material, an internal process takes place permitting this genetic material to be exponentially amplified. An analogy would be a magnifying glass for finding a needle in a haystack, with the needle being the virus and the haystack being any other microorganisms or cells present in the sample. But the crucial caveat is that, according to his inventor, this technique was originally designed for the sole purpose of doing scientific research. Nevertheless, and with explicit rejection from his inventor, throughout the years it has been applied in other areas like medical diagnostic, just like doctors all around are doing for diagnosing COVID-19. According to Mullis himself, applying his test for this purpose is seriously wrong, given that the method cannot give an exact result, but just an approximation. In a journalistic work made for describing exactly this, it is reported that Mullis told, PCR detects a very small segment of the nucleic acid which is part of a virus itself. The specific fragment detected is determined by the somewhat arbitrary choice of DNA sequences used, which become the ends of the amplified fragment. As an example of the profound anti-precise nature of this test, we need to look no further than to the first scientific paper which claimed to have discovered the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Of the samples obtained from the 7 patients, we found that 6 bronchoalveolar fluid and 5 oral swab samples were positive for the virus during the first sampling, as assessed by the PCR test. However, we could no longer detect virus-positive samples from these same patients during the second sampling. Doesn't it sound more like a magic trick than to exact science? Now you see it, now you don't. And to make matters worse, the World Health Organization's orders for using this method makes it even less reliable. According to their official instructions, the genetic material put in the machine has to be amplified 45 times, which directly contradicts Muley's instructions, as described in the book, PCR Protocols. If you have to go more than 40 cycles to amplify a single copied gene, there is something seriously wrong with your PCR technique, because too many cycles increase the amount of non-specific background noise, which means that the test will be detecting something other than what it is supposed to detect. 4. SARS-CoV-2 has never been proven to exist. In the light of the previous point, you might think that the PCR can actually sometimes correctly detect the COVID-19 virus. But you would be wrong. What it does actually detect is a matter of the next point. But for now, let's focus on what it doesn't detect, a new virus. Of all the serious contradictions that the scientific community is performing right now, this one is probably the worst. It is a matter of scientific established protocol that in order to determine the existence of a new virus, it has to go through a laboratory process known as purification, where a centrifuge separates it from other biological elements that come with it. This centrifuge isolation is not even something expensive or hard to do. And yet, not a single one of the scientific teams that claimed to have discovered a new virus has actually made that procedure, as evidenced by the journalist Thorsten Engelbrecht, co-author of the book Virus Mania, how the medical industry continually invents epidemics, making billion-dollar profits at our expense. In this journalistic work, the author stated that we have asked the science teams of the relevant papers which are referred to in the context of the SARS-CoV-2 for proof whether the electron microscopic shots depicted in their in vitro experiments show purified viruses. But not a single team could answer that question with yes. 5. Viruses are an essential part of the immune system. The reason that the PCR test is giving positive results, even when no scientist has been able to demonstrate the existence of a new virus, is because it is detecting something else. But before explaining what it is that the PCR is actually detecting, a little bit of context is due. According to mainstream academic sources, like the Stanford University website, the common cold is a virally related syndrome and has been associated with over 100 different viruses, including human coronavirus and rhinovirus. And now I ask you, have you ever wondered, who is the patient zero when the flu season begins in winter? Do these viruses come out of the ether? Or what exactly happens? The truth of the matter is, those viruses have always been inside of you. They just become activated, and they do that for your own protection. According to the Center for Microbiome at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, there are 380 trillion viruses inside our body. And just like bacteria and fungus are now being considered beneficial for the digestive and immune systems, given that they eat toxins and dead cells, viruses are also starting to be understood as an essential part of the immune system, alongside white cells, immunoglobulins, lymphocytes, and other components of this complex system. But given that the original definition of a virus comes from the Latin translation for poison, the most updated virologists are relabeling them as exosomes. According to some leading-edge virologists like James Hildreth, a virus is fully an exosome in every sense of the word. Or in the words of the American National Institute of Health, which gives to exosomes the name extracellular RNA.
Until recently, RNA was thought to exert its influence only on the cell that produces it. However, we've now learned that these powerful controllers can travel between cells and tissues, altering cells at a distance. Extracellular RNAs, or xRNAs, travel in body fluids, including fluids surrounding the brain and spinal cord, urine, and blood. The extent to which these xRNAs control cell behavior is not well understood. What if scientists could harness the communication powers of xRNA to turn a diseased cell back into a healthy one? scientists may be able to use xRNAs as new treatments for disease. They may also be able to use xRNAs to diagnose diseases earlier than currently possible. This new avenue of research holds enormous promise to understand a myriad of diseases and develop novel therapeutics. Our goals are to understand xRNAs and unlock the transformative potential that this new area of research holds for human health, disease diagnosis, and treatment.
Finally, related to the current coronavirus situation, medical doctors like Andrew Kaufman have found that the characteristics of the so-called SARS-CoV-2 virus are identical to those of human exosomes. Also, he explains that exosomes are released from cells when they are subject to the following conditions: toxic substances, stress and fear, cancer, ionizing radiation, infection, injury, immune response, asthma, diseases in general, and electromagnetic radiation. 6. Viruses cause no disease whatsoever. In the light of the previous point, considering a virus, a fungus, or a bacteria as the cause of a disease is exactly like considering a firefighter as the cause of the fire. Correlation is not causation. But in spite of this, the medical establishment clings onto the notion that some diseases are contagious. In general, they argue in favor of such idea in two ways. A. There are tests that correlate certain microorganisms with certain antibodies. B. There are microorganisms that have supposedly fulfilled the Koch postulates. Both of these arguments will be refuted in that order. As for the first one, a definition for antibodies is needed. According to the Oxford Dictionary of Nursing, it is a special kind of blood protein that is synthesized in lymphoid tissue in response to the presence of a particular antigen and circulates in the plasma to attack the antigen and render it harmless. According to the Medical Encyclopedia of the American National Institute of Health, an antigen is any substance that causes your immune system to produce antibodies against it, such as chemicals, bacteria, viruses, or pollen. Nevertheless, according to the extensive research made by the author of the book, What Really Makes You Ill, the assumption that a particular microorganism causes a particular supposed infection is solely based on the claim that certain antibodies have sometimes been found in samples extracted from some people exhibiting certain symptoms, whether or not a microorganism is present in the sample. In other words, there appears to be a correlation between antibodies and symptoms. Furthermore, the medical establishment interprets the presence of antibodies in the body in two entirely different ways. One interpretation is that the production of antibodies claimed to be specific to a pathogen indicates that the person has immunity to the disease it is said to cause. The other interpretation is that the presence of antibodies means that the person has been infected by a pathogen and has the disease it is said to cause. These interpretations are mutually exclusive. Nevertheless, they are both promulgated by the medical establishment as information about infectious diseases, antibodies, and immunity. It should be obvious, however, that neither interpretation is correct. As a matter of fact, the medical establishment has no idea whatsoever about the real function of the immune system, as evidenced in this article from the Stanford University website, where a specialist in immunology expresses that, "If a patient were to ask me, 'How's my immune system doing today?' I would have no idea how to answer that. And I am an immunologist. None of us can answer that. Right now, we're still doing the same test I did when I was a medical student in the late 1960s. As for the second argument that mainstream scientists give in favor of the false notion that microorganisms cause disease, it should be remembered that for Robert Koch, the proof for that lies on the fulfillment of his four postulates. At first sight, these postulates seem rather commonsensical, and Koch himself claimed to have fulfilled them for the Mycobacterium tuberculosis bacteria. But the truth of the matter is that they haven't been fulfilled a single time in history. But before proving that affirmation, let's first look at the specific case of the first study which claimed to have discovered the supposed SARS-CoV-2. In textual words, there are still many urgent questions that remain to be answered. The association between the SARS-CoV-2 virus and the disease has not been verified by animal experiments to fulfill the Koch postulates to establish a causative relationship between a microorganism and a disease. Another important case in point is that of the SARS-CoV-1, claimed to be discovered in 2002, but never proved to exist as an isolated virus either. Nevertheless, ignoring this crucial step, some scientists have actually claimed to have fulfilled the Koch postulates for it. As Dr. Andrew Kaufman describes,
"So, I came across this article that some of my viewers sent me, and it claims that Koch's postulates have been fulfilled for the SARS virus. And this was published back in 2003 in Nature, which is one of the most prestigious scientific journals. So I want to point out that right here, just between the title and what they say in the body of this article, already they're misleading you. Because in the second paragraph they wrote, according to Koch's postulates as modified by Rivers for viral disease. So it's not Koch's postulates, it's Rivers criteria, which is different. And they should have put that in the title, but they're misleading you to make you think that Koch's postulates have been fulfilled. According to Rivers, there are six criteria to establish virus as a cause of disease. And I'm gonna tell you what those six criteria are. And I'm going to compare and contrast that to Koch's postulates. So you'll see that the color coding tells you which matches up with which. So you can see that there is quite a bit of overlap. So the one that they did not, that Rivers did not require, was that the microorganism is found in ill but not healthy people. So that seemingly was too difficult to prove for Rivers, but I feel that this is a major shortcoming. So I went and looked at Rivers' article from 1937 that where he laid out these six criteria, and I found a few interesting quotes to help us learn a little bit more detail what he was saying. He also said, in the first place, it is not obligatory to demonstrate the presence of a virus in every case of disease produced by it. Now, I really don't understand the reasoning behind this, because if the virus is not present, then how could you say it caused the disease? Okay, so let's get back to this Nature article now that we've reviewed the background information. And it goes on to say that the first three Rivers criteria, which is isolation of the virus from a diseased host, number two, cultivation in host cells, and number three, proof of filterability, have been met for the SARS coronavirus by several groups. And you see at the bottom these footnotes, 2, 3, 4, 5. So here are the four papers that I mentioned that are footnoted that supposedly satisfy the first three criteria of Rivers. So Putanen, Drosten, Kazayachek, and Paris. So let's go back to the article to look at the remaining three criteria. And here's what they said, that they, the authors of this article, have tested for the three remaining criteria. So in conclusion, they met zero of the six criteria. So let me just summarize, because there are several misrepresentations in that article. So first, in the title, they said they satisfied Koch's postulates, but in the second paragraph, they said actually they used Rivers' revision of the Koch's postulates, which are distinct. And then they claimed that four papers satisfied the first three criteria, but upon closer examination of those papers, not one criteria for any of those papers was satisfied. And then they claimed that they satisfied the remaining three criteria, but once again, upon closer examination of their procedures, they did not satisfy any of them. So this is what I would consider a fraudulent paper, because they cannot provide any evidence to back up any of the claims they made in their paper. And it's very, very misleading.
The relevance of this fraudulent paper lies on the fact that it has been a tendency for the scientific community to modify, or better said, to dilute these postulates, given that they cannot fulfill them. Another example of this malpractice was introduced by the scientist Bradford Hill when he formulated a still more diluted version of the Koch postulate. In the words of medical doctor Thomas Cowan, author of the book The Contagion Myth, why viruses, including coronavirus, are not the cause of disease.
Isolate the bacteria or virus, give it to a normal person, and see what happens. We know what happens, which is basically nothing. Now, as a result of this, the people who were convinced that infectious disease was real and that bacteria and then later viruses did actually cause disease, they came to essentially a fork in the road where they couldn't prove Koch's postulates, which is basically the laws of logic. And then they became Rivers' postulates, which Andy in his webinar went through. And then later they became what are called Hill's postulates or Hill's rules. So this I found on Wikipedia as the new way that we decide whether or not a virus is the cause of a disease or a bacteria. Because again, they couldn't prove Koch's postulates, which is basically simple logic. So the solution was to change the postulates. And there's about 10 or 11 of these postulates, which I won't read them all, but I am going to read three. And I just want to point out, these were apparently made in around 1965, middle 60s. And these are still to this day accepted widely by the public health community and by epidemiologists for how we prove viral causation. So let me just read three of them. Number three, causation is likely if there is a very specific population at a specific site with no other likely explanation. In other words, you can now say that a virus caused this disease if a bunch of people get sick and you can't think of another reason why they got sick. Postulate number five says, quote, greater exposure should generally lead to a greater incidence of the effect. That sounds reasonable. However, in some cases, the mere presence of the factor can trigger the effect. In other cases, an inverse proportion is observed. In other words, greater exposure leads to a lower incidence. So if you translate that, what it means is, if you have a greater exposure to this virus, you will have a greater incidence of the disease. Or it may not have any effect on the disease. Or it may lead to a lower effect of the disease or a lower incidence of the disease. I would only say that that covers all your bases. In other words, more exposure could get worse, could be the same, or could get better. And then number eight, is, quote, occasionally it is possible to appeal to experimental evidence, which means, I guess, occasionally it's not possible to appeal to experimental evidence. And so you just have to guess, or you just have to believe that that's what's happened.
And finally, the last and definitive argument against the validity of the Koch postulates lies on the simple logical deduction that the first postulate is unsustainable. In the light of contemporary knowledge, it is evident that what once were regarded as pathogenic external germs do in fact live inside us. For example, this scientific paper begins with the paradoxical claim that Escherichia coli is both a harmless commensal in the intestines of many mammals as well as a dangerous pathogen, even though our understanding of how often and by which mechanisms the bacteria transit from a commensal to a pathogenic lifestyle is still far from complete. The same illogical stance is present in the current coronavirus situation, where the scientific community has been labeling as asymptomatic any person that gives positive for the test but doesn't present symptoms. 7. Deaths attributed to COVID-19 have four causes. According to the government of Italy, 99% of the people that died after testing positive on the PCR test were people that had one or more serious health conditions, In fact, these people didn't die because of a virus. No one has ever died from one. It is simply that doctors are reclassifying every death as COVID-19 if a patient gets positive on their ridiculous PCR party trick test. And sometimes they reclassify without any test at all, as evidence in the guidelines for certifying deaths by the American Center for Disease Control. According to the book, What Really Makes You Ill, and Why Everything You Thought You Knew About Disease Is Wrong, each and every disease is caused by one or more of the following points. Let's briefly describe each one of them. Some toxic substances are the air pollution, the carbon dioxide we exhale, the untreated chemicals of bodily excretions, the untreated chemicals of industrial excretions, the agriculture pesticides, strong drugs, white sugar, food preservatives, various household cleaning and personal hygiene products, the methanol in hand sanitizers, the mercury in the amalgams, the mercury and aluminum of several vaccines, the poisonous chemicals of many, many, many pharmaceuticals, among other types of toxic materials. It should be emphasized that certain places with many deaths attributed to the coronavirus, like Wuhan and Lombardy, have an air quality worthy of a horror movie. Electromagnetic radiation can also come from many sources, like the cell phone, tablets, Wi-Fi, microwaves, satellites, or the radiation coming from 5G antennas. Each of these alter the energetic flow in the body and irritate the cellular tissue. In the case of the 5G technology, it should be emphasized that there is an overwhelming body of evidence of the prejudicial effects it has in our immune system. In fact, this has been the case since the first generation of these antennas. Also, and very relevant to the way in which doctors are diagnosing the symptoms right now, it is a fact that the 5G technology can operate in a range of frequencies that can alter the chemical bond of the oxygen we breathed, making its absorption very hard for some people. A great book on the prejudicial effects of too much electromagnetism is The Invisible Rainbow, an historical description of how every so-called pandemic in the last 100 years has been linked with the introduction of a new electromagnetic technology. Finally, it should be emphasized that Wuhan and New York were some of the first cities to have these 5G antennas installed, although nowadays they're everywhere. Another important factor for the development of symptoms that doctors are labeling as COVID-19 is the use of pulmonary ventilators. According to the German pulmonologist Thomas Bouchard, chairman of the Association of Pneumological Clinics, when we read the first stories and reports from China and Italy, we immediately asked ourselves why intubation was so common there. This contradicted our clinical experience with viral pneumonia. The article continues to say that the truth is, rather than treating respiratory infections, ventilators actually cause them. The suppression of the cough reflex, needed to insert the ventilator tube into the trachea, means sedated patients cannot clear their airway. This leads to fluid buildup, which, along with the bacteria forming around the foreign body, eventually causes serious bacterial infection. It should not be omitted, by the way, that the medical establishment in the USA receives $39,000 from the government for each patient they put on a ventilator. And last, but not least important, the mental states of fear and stress generate inside the body an inundation of the hormones cortisol and adrenaline, which slowly deteriorate the cellular tissues. It really goes without saying that watching the terrible news broadcast 24/7 has exponentially increased the stress and fear in the whole world. Not to mention the uncertainty that people are feeling after losing their jobs. And this is no minor issue, because it generates what medical doctors call the nocebo effect. Just as the placebo effect occurs when a person is able to heal without the use of any pharmaceutical at all, the nocebo effect occurs when a person gets sick without any physical cause for it. Maybe you have heard or seen examples of people that can go through burning cold after getting hypnotized. Well, this is exactly the opposite of what's happening, but on a global scale. These were the four causes of what doctors are labeling as the COVID-19 disease. and now here they are the four remedies for them. As for the fear and stress point, the only remedy is to see through the lies and not give one inch of your emotional and mental energies to the corrupted state of affairs inside the medical mafia. Instead, get your own house in order and appreciate the beauty of life. As for the electromagnetic radiation, the remedy is not to burn down the 5G antennas, but to push through your local government for a way to take them down legally. Also, it could help if you stop viewing as a rockstar the person who's putting hundreds of 5G satellites in orbit each month. As for the inadequate medical procedures, the only remedy is to tell your personal doctor to stop using it so carelessly and educate them on the severe damages that they are causing. Finally, as for the toxic substances point, the remedies are to get as far as possible from the sources of them, and also to begin consuming the opposite of toxic material, fresh, organic, antioxidant-rich food. As the father of Western medicine used to say, let food be your medicine. It is very obvious that many doctors have totally forgotten this crucial instruction, even though they swore an oath on his name when they began to study medicine. 8. Social corruption is the real disease. Before concluding this video and giving a proposal to get out of this madness, it must not go without saying that the mess we are all in has one big, fat, central cause. Corruption. In fact, the web of corruption is so big and its roots are so deep that it is impossible to identify it completely. Instead, a series of what I consider the most important points will be explained. Let's begin with the very famous case in which doctors and scientists were bribed in order to let people think that tobacco cigarettes were not prejudicial to our health. A case in point, that scientists sometimes prefer money rather than the pursuit of truth. A related example comes from the 1986 American Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, which legally blinded every pharmaceutical company from the lawsuits they could receive from the adverse effects, or even deaths, related to every vaccine out there. Another example comes from the General Director of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom, who was reported to repeatedly cover up an epidemic of the cholera disease when he was the health minister in Ethiopia. As a side note, it is very worth mentioning that this epidemic was not due to the Vibrio cholerae bacteria, but instead, it was caused by the extremely poor sanitary conditions in Africa. Speaking of Africa, the autoproclaimed hero of this continent is enmeshed in a very long list of corrupt activities. Leaving aside his connections to the convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, leaving aside his repeated and explicit declarations to reduce the population, leaving aside the fact that his foundation finances many of the main news media out there, which repeatedly make him appear as a literal real-life superhero, there is also abundant evidence that he's been financing different technological companies in order to develop a microchip that could be inserted alongside the vaccine that he's also financing. This chip, alongside the 5G technology, would allow him to know absolutely every detail of your location, health, and economic status. As already said, another tech giant, now the fifth richest person on the planet, has been putting many 5G satellites all around the world in the last several weeks. Yet another technological giant, and the only person in the world that's richer than Bill Gates, has also been enmeshed in irregular activities, like sending scripts to the most popular news media in order to make the population believe that his company, Amazon, is being super responsible with the COVID-19 health crisis. Reality check. This is not journalism, it is propaganda. Speaking of propaganda, the World Health Organization hired a public relations company in order to coordinate celebrities into a unified message that would persuade their fans to follow each of the WHO instructions. The irregular part comes from the fact that this company is the same one that the United Nations hired in the 90s in order to produce a media campaign with actresses like this young girl, which served the purpose of convincing the general public that the United States had the right to wage war against Iraq during the Gulf War. And finally, all of these corruption examples serve the overall purpose of letting the controller of the global economic policies, the World Economic Forum, to have an even bigger and tighter control on our pockets. These people are openly stating that, given the state of affairs in which the world is in right now, there needs to be an economic reset. So, in conclusion, what are the next steps we should take as a global human race? In my opinion, the number one thing we need to do is to take responsibility for our own health and stop depending on the overly corrupt medical and pharmaceutical establishment. If we keep trusting these people, our fate will be the same as that of the frog in the pot. My point is not that all doctors are corrupt, but that most of them seem hermetically closed to any arguments outside of what they learned in school, and therefore are the cause of all the censorship that's taking place right now. It seems that their current dogma is, if you cannot win the debate, you have to cancel it. To conclude, here's a quote from the book Goodbye Germ Theory, Ending a Century of Medical Fraud. In a very real sense, the science of medicine is more like a dogmatic religion, preaching eternal damnation to non-believers and excommunication in the form of the licensing in jail for non-conformists. The ultimate demons in this religion are the germs, a group of diabolical opportunists who attack and take advantage of otherwise good and wholesome God-loving folks. You are defenseless against these evils unless you pray with the high priests of medicine, who act as an intermediary between you and God. If you pray with them hard enough, maybe God will help you. Please take these words into consideration, not in a matter of derision, but as a wake-up call for these crazy times. It seems to me that we are on the verge of a second scientific revolution, and we have the choice of either looking through the telescope with the Galileos of our time, or to fall back into a very dark age of scientific dictatorship.